Welcome to episode 102 of the Horror Podcast. My name is Tyler, and I run Signal Horizon, a magazine dedicated to exploring genre fiction in and out of the classroom.
And I'm Oren Gray, and I screw around and do stuff and occasionally write for Signal Horizon and miss my cues when we're running the show, obviously. And lately I've been reading about role-playing games I can't play because of the pandemic, because life's amazing. So, yeah.
I'm still waiting on my role-playing invite there.
You know, so I've screwed around with like Roll20 and stuff, and it is super cool, but it is also like way too intense for me.
Yeah,
like, it's a lot of work to run something as powerful as that thing is, which is, again, it's cool, but damn.
Yeah, it's got a lot going on. I kind of explored that at the beginning of all of this because, you know, kind of the televised version of Dungeons and Dragons is or I should say, like, streamed version is really popular. That is a ass ton of work.
I'm playing in a game of it that seems to be going pretty well. We've played one whole session. But, you know, it's really cool, and Roll20 is cool, and it's awesome, but, like, to go to the back end and actually, like, see the work you do as the GM, like, once you learned it, the system seems really robust and powerful, but, like, learning it, it's like, nope.
Nope. Yeah. Well, it's not a Dungeons & Dragons podcast, it is the Horror Podcast. So, for those of you that are brand new to us this season, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about what we've been watching and reading and playing in this particular episode. And then we will present to you some free genre content that we have found on the internet. And finally, we'll spend the remainder of tonight's episode discussing the cinematic version of Anarchy that is Gremlins 2: The New Batch. As you might have noticed this season, you can check out all of our back episodes on iTunes and other podcatchers. And starting with this episode, you can find all of the live video version of each episode up on the Signal Horizon YouTube channel. We are super stoked to have that video version this year, and it will take a little getting used to looking at my ugly mug the whole time.
I will try and, like, remember to not just wander off in the middle of the episode or something, like, oh, I'm gone.
Yeah, right. Not... Like, I gotta pee. Everybody could see that, Oren. What are we doing?
I'm not accustomed to this. This whole video thing yet, so we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting, but it's gonna be great. So let's start off by talking a little bit about what we've been reading, watching. What's going on over at Castle Gray? What have you been reading, watching, all that jazz?
I watched Extro 3 today. Not one or two, but three, and that was a whole thing. It's super cheap, but, like, kind of good, but also, like, so mystifying having seen Extra 1, because they're not, like, at all similar to one another, but they're made by the same person. So, like, it's the same director, but it feels like a cheap Italian knockoff version, and not even that. Like, it feels like a cheap Italian knockoff version of some other movie, not Extra. It's very strange. But yeah, so I watched that today. That was an adventure.
So if other people wanted to keep up on your letterbox, if you will, where did you watch it? Did you?
So I got the Blu-ray from one of Vinegar Syndrome's, like, big sales a while back. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere or not. I'm sure it is somewhere, but I don't know. So
yeah,
you can get it from Vinegar Syndrome still.
Yeah. And Vinegar Syndrome's awesome, man. They have so many. Like, every time that I've seen them at a festival or whatever, it just blows my mind what the new stuff is that they're bringing out.
The number of times I go to Analog Sunday, back when going to things was still something we could do, and see a movie, and then, like, 2 months later, Vinegar Syndrome puts it on Blu-ray is very high.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's awesome, and also indicative of the kinds of stuff you can get from Vinegar Syndrome. And also the kind of movie Extra 3 is. I would absolutely... the kind of movie I would have seen at an Analog Sunday. So...
Very cool. Anything else you want to highlight? I mean, it's been a month since we've had an episode. You know, we kind of...
Man, so, like, during the pandemic, I have not watched as much stuff, which is weird, because I've been stuck at home, so you'd think I would, but I have not been for what, like, I can't, like, I sit down to read or watch something or something, and I just can't for some reason, so, like, I haven't been watching a ton, but I did watch, like, the entire, like, Shinya Tsukamoto box set that Arrow put out that's, like, Tetsuo the Iron Man, and then all the other stuff, not all of his other stuff, but 10 movies total. So I watched all of that last month, and that was a lot. That's mostly what I've been watching lately. But it was good stuff. All worth watching. Absolutely. Well, with maybe one exception, but
yeah, that is the ultimate conundrum, right? Like, I battle a little bit of anxiety anyways, and it, like, especially with school coming back, my anxiety level has been, like, on a 10. And I can't sit through a 90 minute movie if I'm that anxious. And it doesn't matter if it's horror, or it doesn't matter if it's a drama or a comedy. It's like, even shit I love, I'm like, I can't do it.
I need to sit
on this couch and you know, dwell on stupid shit that I can't control.
I just can't seem to commit to things, like, you know, I can't, like, I sit down to try and watch a movie and I can't pick one. I'm just like, oh God, what do I don't know. I don't know what to watch. And, like, I sit down to read a book and I'm like, oh, that's, I don't know, it just seems like too much. Which I think is why I've been doing so much of the, like, gaming stuff and everything, because I can read it in tiny little pieces. Like, it's like, here's two paragraphs about this thing. It's like, oh, two paragraphs. I can do two paragraphs.
Yeah, I can commit to that.
Right,
yeah,
I can handle two paragraphs. That seems reasonable.
Yeah. But that's, I'm trying to put together a couple of reviews for some short story collections that I've gotten. And, like, it's like 27 pages. That's a novella, you know? Like, I was promised short stories. I want, you know, like, really what I want
three
is a collection
pages.
Of flash. Right, like flash fiction. That's right. What I need to read, because that's my attention span right now. Speaking of my attention span, I have gotten it together enough to watch some, I think, pretty interesting films. The first is a film from 2014 that I'm just really, like, late to the show on. It's called Coherence, and I described it to our television editor as, like, Cube if you cut out all the interesting stuff, and I still really liked it, all right? So, like, I that is not a knock on the film, but it is...
If it was just some dude's living room.
Yes! No, 100%, that's what it is. Yeah?
I've actually seen it, but I've read about it, so...
Yeah, it's got, like, a ton of shit about, like, quantum physics, of which I think is mostly, like, psychobabble, but, it was interesting.
Actually,
and
so it's actually Cube 2... If it was someone's living room.
I had no idea you were a Cube originalist, you know?
I'm just saying Cube 2 is the quantum physics one. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I remember Cube 2 because it had that really rad scene where, like, time slowed down, right? And, like, you saw, like, 40 versions of, you know, a couple of the characters. Yeah,
so
it was cool.
Like,
so,
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt your coherence thing again. Apparently, so, like, my favorite thing in Cube 2, and this is almost literally all I remember about Cube 2. So... I'm going to spoil some Cube 2, so if you haven't seen Cube 2 yet, probably don't worry about it. But, so, like, Cube 2, you know, it's Cube, except that there's also time travel somehow, right? Basically, like, the cubes move through time as well as space.
Yeah.
And so you end up with multiple versions of the same person running around, at very sense, right? And so you've got this guy, and his, like, signature character thing is this watch he wears, right? That, like, his dad gave him or something. That's like a Rolex, and he wears it. It's like a gold watch. Or maybe he got it for, like, a retirement thing. I don't know. Anyway, he's got this gold watch. It means a lot to him. And he goes crazy, and later, like, he kills the first one of himself that he sees and takes the watch and puts it on, so he's got two. And then he disappears for a while, and when he shows back up at the very end, his arm is just watches all the way up, which is so fucking great.
Yeah, it is. Here's the thing. I'm a sucker for all those movies, even when they got fucking...
I'm not sure I ever saw the third one, but...
I feel like there are four of... I don't know. But anyways, I appreciate all of those movies, which is part of the reason why I liked Coherence, because I kind of like that... You know what? Let's try to figure out what timeline we're in. Let's try to figure out what's going. You know, and
right.
so it is the not that there is a ton of action in those movies to begin with, but it's like wiping out all of that action and just having all the talky-talky stuff.
Yeah,
so if you like talky-talky movies,
I do.
Then this is your shit. So a couple of other movies I want to highlight. Number one, I'm not going to say anything about it because it's still under, you know, I'm still under strict embargo from the Fantasia Film Festival. But I checked out The Oak Room, which is, I would say, barely on the line of genre, but it is a movie. It's a Canadian film. It feels very Canadian. But it's a great dialogue on how to tell a story. And they kind of tell the middle part at the end and the beginning part in the middle, and they kind of mess it all up, but it's really interesting. So worth your watch. I'll have a full in-depth review once that embargo lifts.
Yeah.
And there ain't no shit of an embargo on The Host, which you can now stream on Shudder because everybody loves it and everybody's been talking about it. It is a Screen Life film, so it's like all created on Zoom, and it was created during the quarantine. It's a great, spooky little film, man. And here's the best part. 60 minutes. It is a tight 60 minutes, man. I talk about things that I'm down for. I saw the runtime. I'm like, shit, this is it, you know?
So I had not heard of The Host for whatever reason before it came out. But before it dropped on Shudder, I hadn't heard anything about it. And then I kept seeing people posting about it, like on Twitter or on Letterboxd or whatever, but I didn't see the poster. I just saw them talking about The Host. And I was like, why the fuck is everybody seeing the Bong Joon-ho movie from, like, 2006 or whatever just now?
Yeah, that's like, what I thought originally,
like,
too.
Why is this trending on Twitter or whatever? Like, what happened?
Yep. Way different films. Yeah, way different. What is a really rad, big creature film, and this is a tiny little... And, like, a bulk of that movie is outside, right? Like, it's all big and right. open and
yep.
you know, whatever. Not this film. It is small and quarantine-esque and, yeah, a ton of fun. I don't know what the runtime is for The Host, but I guarantee you it is much more than 60 minutes.
I'm sure it is more than
60
minutes, yes.
So, yeah, man, that has been pretty much my life, is trying to avoid children's cartoons, find some sanity to watch some horror films, and then, you know,
yeah.
kind of converse with you when I can. So,
I am easing back into watching movies. I hope so. I hope July will be more movies than.
Yeah, this is hurting your total.
May and June was. Yeah, my total is not great. Or I'm sorry, not July. Man. August. I'm hoping August will be more. Like, July was more than June. June was my worst month since I started keeping score, which was like 5 years ago.
So. Yeah, I need to. I upload all my shit on Letterboxd. I guess you can search me up on Letterboxd and you know, see what my quick version of all of these films and what I thought of them. But it's a great little app I like to use.
So. I'm also on Letterboxd, and you know, if you hate movies, you can also be on Letterboxd apparently, because everyone on Letterboxd hates movies as near as I can tell.
I ignore everybody else. Like, unless there's somebody I follow, like friends or, you know, whatever. Like, I only follow, like, five people. I don't even follow you, but I do follow Phil Jalot.
I don't read, like, anybody. But, like, so every time I go to log a movie, first I have to look it up, right? You have to look up the movie and then log it. So I look it up and pull it up, and then I always, because I'm curious, I scroll down. If it's the first time I've seen the movie, I scroll down and see what everybody else, like, what the top few reviews at the bottom thought. And, like, everybody fucking hates movies. Everybody. They're always like, this movie was the worst movie I've ever seen, like, every time. It's like, I saw you just say that about a different movie, same guy.
Yeah, man. The problem with, like, Rotten Tomatoes or Amazon, which we'll see in a minute, everybody's a goddamn critic, and everybody thinks that they're, you know, it's like, look, dude. I don't really give a shit what you have to say.
I barely
give a shit what I have to say.
Man, so, I barely say anything on Letterboxd. Like, my reviews on Letterboxd are like a sentence.
You're better than me.
It's like stuff
I just give
tweet.
I just give the star and then move on. Like, fuck that. And most of the time, because I'll write a full review for the website or something. You know,
right.
So. All right. Go ahead.
I do follow, like, Nathaniel. Thaxne, NathaxNne, on Letterboxd, and they, all of their reviews are like weird stream of consciousness prose poetry. They're amazing.
All right, all right. We'll have to put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, add it to I'll the do script that.
So
yeah,
that
yeah,
everybody
yeah.
could see it. I love it. I love it. And while you're doing that, we'll quickly move to our dark corner of the web, which is the time of the podcast where we give you some free content that you can check out on the internet. And it comes to us via a wonderful little app that you can get on like pretty much any streaming device called Tubi. Tubi TV is offering this month The Taking of Deborah Logan, which is one of my favorite kind of weird found footagey. It's got a shit ton to say about aging, and I feel like there have been a bunch of movies lately that have kind of dealt with that subject matter. Mm-hmm. But it also has one of the most horrific fucking scenes I've ever seen. So,
and if you're on the internet at all and are active in horror circles at all, you've seen that scene already because it is famous in GIF form, but you don't know what movie it's from. So,
like, it's one of my favorite GIFs, but every time I like use it on Twitter or wherever, I always kind of feel guilty, you know? Like, fuck. Because it's so good.
It's so good.
And it's like, whoa!
Fortunately, the rest of the movie is also super good.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And for the first, like, third, it feels like it's going to be, like, a generic possession-y movie.
Correct.
But it's got, like, snake cults and shit before it's over, so you're in good shape. It's great.
It's got two or three, like, hard turns to it. And
I love it.
A couple of red herrings, and it's, yeah. And some kind of interesting creature work, too.
That's from the guy who made, it's before he made it. It was his first thing. But it's from the same guy made Escape Room, which I haven't seen yet, but was really popular, so.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I kind of dug Escape Room. It's got, obviously, some really cool set pieces and, you know, some other stuff like that. So.
Yeah, so he made
interesting.
He made that, and then he made the fourth Insidious movie, and then he made Escape Room, so.
Yeah, I don't know about the Insidious movie, but
it was pretty
definitely
good.
Those two
It's pretty good. The fourth one, it's got story problems, but, like, directing-wise, it's pretty good, so.
Okay.
I'm a big Insidious apologist, though. It's better than 3.
I mean, I don't know if that's if that's the argument you want to go with. All right. So this leads us excitingly into tonight's essential question. Does Gremlins 2 capture the anti-corporate nature of pop culture in the 1980s and early 1990s? Or is Gizmo the true monster?
Remember the last time? We told you not to feed them after midnight. We told you to keep them away from the light. And the most important warning of all, we told you to never, ever get them wet. You didn't listen.
They're mutating.
Sir, is the building on fire?
No, that's a false alarm.
Are you trying to panic New York City?
Absolutely not. So the monsters are real?
I didn't say that.
Gremlins 2. The new batch.
Now, was that civilized? No, clearly not. Fun, but in no sense civilized.
Okay, so for those of you that are living under a rock and don't know what the plot of this movie that is like 30 years old is about, the lovely folks over at Rotten Tomatoes have provided the novella of a summary of which I'm going to read you now. Where the original Gremlins was a horror film spiked with comedy, Gremlins 2 The New Batch is essentially a black comedy with a couple of horrifying touches. As the film starts, the fantastical trinket shop in Chinatown, which sold the Mogwai in the first film, is demolished by a crazy multimedia businessman called Daniel Clamp. The heroes from the first movie, Billy and Kate, happen to work for Clamp in his huge high-rise. They find the Mogwai with Clamp's building, but not before he has accidentally spawned legions of mischievous lizard-like gremlins. Soon, the gremlins are wreaking havoc throughout the building. In the original film, their misdeeds were violent, but here they're also goofy and quite satirical. Director Joe Dante has filled this film with quick verbal and visual jokes, which for many makes Gremlins 2 The New Batch a satire and inversion of the typical horror movie. All right, man. So a couple of important things I want to address before we get in with it. Number one, when we were putting together our list of movies that we had to talk about this year, you like shouted this one at me, right? There, I could see the eagerness behind your eyes. Tell me why this one?
So like, first of all, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. So this is like jostling for a spot. You know how Letterboxd has that like your favorite four movies that you have to pick? This is jostling for a spot there pretty much always. I also think it is basically the perfect sequel. It is a sequel that in every respect is superior to the first movie, and also shoots itself in the kneecap so there can never be another one. It's amazing.
I mean, I guess they could make another one, right? Do you think they could?
I also think it's great for the moment we're living in right now, both because, there's a bunch of little... I realized this as I was, like, a number of times now I've been having conversations with people online and have sent them, say, a clip from this movie or something, because there's the canned food and shotguns line, which comes up all the time. There's the end of the world video, which is, what was it, Ted Turner, who supposedly really had one of those.
There's
that clip.
Yeah, and clearly, like, from a, like, multimedia standpoint, from, the Clamp building and Clamp Industries and all that kind of shit, that's all a stand-in for Ted Turner. I mean, very clearly is, right?
Yeah, like, it's Jesus.
Yeah, like, he's got,
it's,
like...
It's Ted Turner and Donald Trump mixed together. Like, I mean, that's essentially, like, Daniel Clamp is every sort of media, or every, not media, but every sort of very public billionaire that we had back in the 90s.
Yeah, except it does this weird thing, right? And, you know, be prepared. We will spoil the end of this 30-year-old film here. But, like, Clamp kind of redeems himself.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like
that's the only problem with this movie, and it's not even a problem with the movie, but it's a problem with the movie in our current moment, which is that Clamp is not an evil person. And,
he's
the real
just clueless,
Ted Turner and Donald
right?
Trump are.
Yeah, well, and it has this like I think the movie has a real hard edge to it where it is discussing kind of like bougie corporatism, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, we have picked your art out for you, and, you know, only this really rich shit, and everything is really very conscious of the class, right? Of mm-hmm. you know, the way they want to be perceived. And then you have this guy come in who is very mogul-esque, but then at the end it's like he's the Grinch. Like, that's the character he reminded me of, is like his heart grew like two or three times its size, you know, and it is very strange.
I always got the impression that he was never evil. Like, he wasn't why his corporation was that way.
It just happened.
he was clueless. He was privileged, right? He had the privilege of never seeing how his business ran and of never seeing what the consequences of his actions were. He lived in an office that was literally so high it was above the clouds.
Yeah.
Like, when you see his office out the windows, you can just see the tops of the clouds and you can see a plane flying by. Like, he literally was so high up he never saw what the consequences of his actions were. And so he was this kind of nice guy who, because he just didn't pay attention, caused all this terrible havoc with the best intentions. Like,
Yeah, well, and you see a little bit of that, like at the beginning of the film, kind of the first time you really meet him, and like he has a real interaction with one of the main characters. You know, we already have the idea that this corporation is really shitty because of how it treats Billy, right? Like, you know, his direct boss is trying to seduce him, and then like the boss above her is just a total fucking dickhead, right?
Right.
And so like when he comes down and he meets Billy, all of the things that have been criticized before, right? Suddenly, Daniel Clamp is like, oh, how great is that? And you know, how quaint, and you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he might belittle them, but he's a hell of a lot, you know, like he doesn't reject it on face just because it is not the corporate culture or whatever, right. You know, which I always found really, really interesting. I also, one of the things that you brought up that I think bears a little more discussion is the idea of high rise as metaphor, right?
Right.
Like we get this real distinct feeling that this high rise represents not only class, but also respect and some other things that bring with it. And it reminded me of a movie from, I think, 2014 called High Rise. Have you seen that?
Yep. Yeah. The, from the Ballard novel, right? J.G. Ballard?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's directed by Ben Wheatley. And,
right. It was really good. It has Loki in it.
Yeah. And Jeremy Irons, who's fucking great. Yeah. But it is a weird, weird piece of filmmaking.
Oh, it is,
you know?
Super weird. And it has, like, the most amazing song cover. It has that Portishead cover of S.O.S., which is just strange but awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll try to find it. Look it up. add it for the audio version.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, like, in that, like, where Gremlins 2 uses it as a loose metaphor, that's, like, a hard metaphor, you know? Like, it's very clearly trying to do something.
Oh, yeah.
But I loved the idea that the movie feels like a video game from time to time, in that they have to literally cover levels to get to the basement, you know?
Right, yeah. And, like, well, part of the things, like, one of the things I love about Gremlins 2 is that, like, it is super satirical, but it is so satirical that it never stays in one place long enough to be, like, to be the level of metaphor that, like, High Rise is, because it is it is literally satirizing everything. It's satirizing itself. Like, it is.
Oh, for sure.
It is a parody of the notion of a sequel.
Yeah, like, that is, I mean, at one point in time, there is this great moment in the film where, like, the reel blows up, right? And we pause from the film itself, you know? It's very self-referential, which I think is super.
The original Gremlins was really satirical and really self-referential too, but, like, not anywhere near to the same degree, which I think is one of the things that makes Gremlins 2, like, so great, is, like, the idea of making a sequel is itself kind of absurd, right? Like, Most movies do not lend themselves to sequels, and so to make a sequel in the first place, you have to stretch, like you have to kind of contort the story. And Gremlins 2 is a parody of that idea of contorting the story, where it's like, yes, we're going to do more and bigger of everything, and we're going to bring back everything from the first movie, even the people who were dead, and we're going to bring back, and we're going to do all this stuff, and like just cram it all in, and it's such a huge joke at its own expense.
Yeah, and that's how this movie manages to be mean. Because there are, I think there are elements of Gremlins 1, right, that are fucking mean. And we think of it as this kind of cuddly, fun horror/comedy, but
it's super mean-spirited.
Oh, and like we get in the first film, right, the kind of description of how it's a little in the middle of the film, right, just as we are starting to explore some of Kate and Billy's relationship, she goes through, I believe, how her dad died.
It's how her dad died on Christmas coming down
right
the chimney.
And it's so fucked up, right? Like it's dark and mean, and I love how in the second film, right, she starts to do the same thing.
Yeah. Like,
and Billy's like, we ain't got time for this shit.
You know? Right. Everybody's like, no, we can't deal with that right now. And like wanders off. Yeah.
Right. And I love that Joe Dante's like, yeah, we're not going to do that shit. Not this time. You know, like we're just going to make a really silly satirical film and not try to worry about being too horrific, you know, which I think is kind of why that part exists. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like Gremlins 1 is very mean-spirited and very cruel to a lot of its characters.
Yeah.
And Gremlins 2 is cruel to itself instead, and is kind to pretty much all of its characters. Like, even the biggest assholes in Gremlins 2 survive. Pretty much no one dies. Like, the body count in Gremlins 2 is basically zero. I mean, some people probably die off camera, but no one who has a name. Like, no named character dies, pretty much. And, like, everyone essentially gets a happy ending, with the possible exception of that one huge asshole dude. Like, Billy's skeezy boss gets promoted, Daniel Clamp turns out to be a nice guy and saves the city. Like, everyone is fine. Everyone is better off at the end than they were when they started. And so it's like, it's so the opposite of Gremlins 1 in that regard, where everyone is fucked over.
Half
the characters are dead and the other half are miserable.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. Like, even the meanest person in this film, right? Which is arguably Forster, who's played by Robert Picardo, and my little nerd voice is, you know, telling me to say that he plays like the virtual doctor in Voyager. He's fucking great, but he's got hair in this film, which is bizarre. But like, he's the meanest dude, and the worst thing that happens to the meanest dude is that he's like what seduced by the, you know, female gremlin, right?
Right. Yeah.
So. Yeah, like, I love that at the end of the day, you're right. Like, we don't get that gremlins are killing a whole ton of people.
Right.
I should also say, if we're going to talk some about the kind of bit characters, this movie's got Christopher Lee in it.
It does. He's so great. Who does die, but...
Yeah, I mean, and he is just playing this kind of big, you know, like, campy, goofy... doctor, you know, that is willing to, you know, essentially inoculate everyone with whatever hormone he's got laying around, right?
Which, yes, as you point out in the notes, that's totally how hormones work.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Right, there's a brain hormone, yep. Right?
And I do like the, like, they... Yeah, I mean, this is... I see, like... Joe Dante has made a lot of films, and they are across a very broad spectrum of kinds of movies, but fundamentally, 90% of them are parodies, right? Even the most serious ones, they're parodies to some degree or another. Like, there's a little bit of satire in almost every Joe Dante film.
Sure.
But, like, Gremlins 2 is midway between his most serious films and his Looney Tunes movie that he made, right? Like, it's basically a cartoon. It's essentially a live-action cartoon. Like, the most obvious of those is like when the brain gremlin drinks the brain hormone and transforms. He gets glasses, which is 100% how DNA works.
Right.
It can make you have glasses. Right. Like that's a cartoon thing. That is something that would happen in like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Which the movie also nods to by having the little Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck cartoon at the beginning.
Yeah, right.
It's
Kissing Cousins.
Right. It's just it's a Warner Brothers cartoon. It's a live action Warner Brothers cartoon that happens to be about weird monsters. It's so good.
Yeah, well, and I think you highlight one of those issues that I really want to talk about, which is like this film is not meant to be taken straight up. No. Right? Which is part of the reason why I loved it so much as a kid, and my parents were lukewarm, because they were like, we don't really know what to do with this film, right?
No one seems to know what to do with this film.
Right. But as a kid, you're like, this is fucking great, you know? And so, clearly, Joe Dante is telling all of us that this is the film that we're going to get, because of the the kind of the way that the React structure works is I have kind of painted it out, right? The end of the first act, we get this weird troupe of mimes that's just coming in, right? Yep. Out of nowhere. And yep. It's so random and weird. And that's our first sign that we are not in for a typical film.
Well, like, every time you see New York, every time you see the outside of the building, which is like three times, but every time you see it, it's a cartoon version of New York, right? Like, it's got mimes, it's got, like, angry cabbies, it's got crowded Times Square, their apartment is, like, above an adult video store or something. Like,
yeah,
it's a cartoon version of New York. It's not a real place.
Yeah, and so, like, that gets us into the second act, and then between the second and the third act, we get that whole melting of the film, and fucking Hulk Hogan yelling at gremlins, like, in the booth, and then they listen to him, which is what is, I'm like, whoa, man, right? Yeah. But I love that, like, at the beginning of every act, we you know, to start the film, we get the cartoon, the actual cartoon. Mm-hmm. To start the second act, we get the mimes. And to start the third act, we get Hulk Hogan. Like, man, there are no clearer signs that this shit is going to be bonkers.
Partway through, we get Leonard Maltin showing up reviewing the first movie.
Right. Like, shittily, too, right? Like, yeah. It's really
like,
bad.
Like, shitting on it, yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, it's... Yeah, I love it. And I love its self-centered. And so...
Yeah,
I've listened to the commentary tracks. I've read a little bit about it. Like, Joe Dante didn't ever want to make a Gremlins 2, right? It was one of those things where Gremlins made a whole bunch of money, and the studio was like, you should make a Gremlins 2. And he's like, okay, sure, fine. And so he made this thing. He made this like, vicious takedown of the idea of doing a sequel to Gremlins, that is a parody of the whole idea of sequels from top to bottom, that just undercuts everything it's doing at every turn. And so, like, that is a baller move. You want me to make a sequel? I'm going to make the ultimate anti-sequel.
I think, really, and this is what I said immediately after the rewatch, this is Joe Dante's X-Men movie. Right, like we're very open and obvious about, like, he really wanted to make X-Men was really popular at that point in time. He's like, hey, pay me money to make it, and I'll make these with people instead of gremlins. But he didn't have that opportunity, so we got the Electro Gremlin, right? we got weird, creepy spider, you know, Spider Spike, which is great and fucking terrifying, but. Yeah, man. Like,
we got the actual Harryhausen stop motion Bat Gremlin, which is like actually brought to life with stop motion. Which, like, that's clearly just Joe Dante. Like, oh, I want to do a stop motion sequence.
Right. I'm doing this shit.
This happens for no reason. It has no bearing on the plot at all, and it gets what's his name back into the building. That you could have done that any number of ways.
Right. Yeah. So, in my research of this film. That, like, kind of, it feels like a throwaway scene, right? Like, it feels like, oh, there's this really cool bat, and I can film some stop motion stuff, so we're doing it, right? But the original ending of this film was going to be much, much fucking darker and, like, much heavier, no pun intended. They were going to take what they learned about the concrete, right, and pump the entire building full of concrete and, like, just... kill all of the gremlins that way, which I think is like way darker than the way that we ended up going with it, and like kind of proves that the nature of the film is bending away from that arc, you know?
Yeah.
It's definitely not doing that. So this film is not perfect by any stretch. And one of the things I wanted to talk about, because it does bear some interesting discussion from an educational standpoint. Like, the gremlins feel a little rapey from time to time, right? And that's not wonderful. Did you pick up on that? Am I being overly sensitive? I could be. I don't know.
I mean, so are you referring to the interactions between the female gremlin and the guy, or the rest of the film?
Well, they always feel like the single female that is accosted by a gremlin, both in this film, but in the first film as well. Like, there feels a danger that is not always just a danger to her life. And maybe I'm extrapolating that from, like, when they get rid of the film, right? The first film mm-hmm. they put on the nudie cutie,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, right. And like, they are sexual creatures, you know? And so it's like, man, I don't know if this part would hold up all that great, you know? Like, but, you know.
My reading, and again, this is not borne out by, like, canon. I don't have any evidence, any, like, extra textual evidence to back this up. My reading of the Gremlins has always been that they want to create trouble, right? They're not actually out, which one of the things I love about them, they're monsters that are not out to hurt people. If they hurt people, that's great, but that's not their goal. Their goal is to cause trouble that may or may not also hurt people. Like, they're fine with hurting people. That's cool. And hurting people is a way to cause trouble, so they'll do it. Absolutely.
Yeah, but I think that's fair.
They will also do literally anything else that makes things go wrong.
Yeah, so that trouble is the real part.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, including right. kill themselves.
Yeah.
They frequently kill themselves or one another in right. their effort to cause some sort of mischief.
Yeah, they become then these beings of, like, amoral behavior, right? Like, it's not that, like, they are bad, it's just that they're beings of entropy, and sometimes right. folks that value organization, you know, think that they're evil as a result.
Like, one of the things, like, that is sort of intrinsic to the whole idea of them is that they are essentially a manifestation of entropy, right? They are the fact that machines break down. And that's where gremlins come from. They were mechanical right. problems that happened to planes. That's what gremlins were. And in both movies, they are the fact that systems break down. In Gremlins 2, they're essentially already there before they show up. The building is already beginning to malfunction before yeah. they even come, and they just exacerbate that yeah. breakdown. And, like, at the end, Daniel Klemp says, you know, maybe I didn't build a building for people, I built a building for things.
Yeah, that's great. That's a weird bit of, like, this movie is so kind of anti-capitalism, which is kind of what we alluded to in the essential question. I'm down for the anti-capitalism stuff, right? Like, I think that's an interesting argument. Although we never really get, like, they produce stuff, but it's not, like, an actual industry of any kind, you know?
Right.
In fact, they list, like, three or four different things that Klemp Industry does. And then one of them, I forget what it is, but it's really weird.
A popular line of jams and jellies.
Yeah, right! It's jams and jellies. It's fucking random, right? So, like, I'm down for that anti-corporate message, but it's also got this very weird anti-technology, right? Like, an almost Heidegger-esque argument it's making about why technology is bad. And then with all of the laboratory stuff, it's a little anti-science, right? Or it's yeah, a little like, I mean, I don't know. It's got a weird message.
I feel like the laboratory stuff is very, like, 90s. That is very much yeah. Like, if you watch any horror movie from the 90s, we were super concerned about genetic testing on animals, specifically.
Yeah.
Like, animal testing was a huge fucking deal.
Yep, yeah.
In horror movies in the 90s, like, there are so many movies about that. And so
yeah,
I think
you're absolutely right.
I feel like
yeah.
that's very much a kind of a zeitgeist thing with the genetics lab.
I think that's fair. Yeah,
and also
holding
it
to that
excuse
standard.
To have,
yeah.
Also an excuse to have weird X-Men gremlins.
yeah. But they're the best fucking part, dude.
Oh, they're so
like,
good.
If you can get beyond, like, oh, there's a fruits and vegetables hormone, you know?
The fruits and vegetables gremlin.
Yeah. Yeah, I would totally have cuddled with one of those when I was
so
a kid.
Good.
Hell yeah. Yeah. But, I think it's arguments about, like, fascism and neocapitalism, I think, are totally relevant, you know?
Yeah.
And the other thing that makes this movie so really interesting is it's got an anti-capitalism argument at its core, I think. But what I do remember of when this film came out, we had fucking Gizmo on everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And which a joke they make literally in this movie about the suction cups on the car windows. Like, that was an actual product they made. Like,
yeah.
They're taking aim at their own product.
Yeah, man. And I love that, A, Dante does that, and B, the studio's like, fuck it.
I don't know. I feel like studios back in the 90s obviously just didn't watch the movies they were putting out. They must have interfered a lot on the front end, but like by the time the movie was done, they were like, fuck it, release it. I don't care.
Yeah.
What's it about? I don't know.
Well, and here's the thing. I guarantee you, regardless of all of the messaging that Dante puts in there, Gizmo still sells. Like, I remember they sold those Rambo Gizmos, and I wanted one so goddamn bad. Yeah. They were so cool.
They made a video game of this movie, which I had on Nintendo at one point. I mean, you're drinking from a fucking Gremlins tiki mug right now. No matter how anti-capitalist things are, they're going to sell it to us later.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Yeah, dude. And here's the thing. I didn't buy that when I was a kid. I asked for that for Christmas, and my in-laws got it for me. I mean, shit got its hooks in me early, you know?
It's like, there will never be a more perfect encapsulation of both how capitalism works and the futility of anti-capitalist messaging in media than the fact that RoboCop had a kids cartoon show.
Yeah.
Spinoff from it, let alone a bunch of toy lines. Oh god, so many toy lines.
Oh, so many. Yeah, but like, you're 100% right.
RoboCop is the most anti-capitalist, anti-fascist, least child appropriate movie maybe ever made.
Yeah. Well, I think all of those messaging arguments have led me to this declaration. I think Gremlins 2 could be the perfect film to watch in our current political climate. Okay? And here's why. Number one, most of the film, I would say like 90% of the film, takes place in one building, right? It's on lockdown. Very specifically, it's on lockdown, right? Yep. So we have the setting. Second, I think we have clueless politicians and business leaders that don't understand human beings as human beings outside of like the capital of which they can accrue, right? At one point in time, Clamp says, somebody says, there are real human beings in the building. And then he says, you're right, there are real human beings in the building. Do you know the lawsuits we are facing?
Yep.
Which, like, floored me, because right before I watched this movie, I was reading about Mitch McConnell's new stimulus package and how liability protection is his number one, like, ask, you know? He's like, fuck human beings. Or actually, yes, I appreciate human beings, but only as these entities that may sue their employers if their employers kill them. It was nuts to me, right? Yeah. So, it's a perfect film because it captures that. And, I think generally the brain character is brilliant. But, a quote that you alluded to earlier is, you know, he's talking about what people need to invest in, right? Which, right. I could totally see him popping up on Fox News, like, you know, telling people to buy, like, seeds and gold or whatever. But he's like, it's time to invest in shotguns and canned goods.
Yes, I'd say it's a full-scale panic. Are you having a run on the bank scare yet? Well, it's rather brutal here. We're advising our clients to put everything they've got into canned food and shotguns.
Yep.
But, like, time is a flat motherfucking circle, you know?
And,
like, we are exactly in, you know, this movie right now.
So, like, rewatching it, too, a thing I loved is that when he says that, like, when he's on the phone, because the Gremlins have broken into, like, a stock exchange, like a stock market office, right? It's a real firm. Like, it's a Piers and Morgan or something. It's a real stock firm. Like, someone let them use their actual stock firm name, anyway, to shoot that scene of him telling people to invest in Camp with Giant Guns. Like, it's so... Again, it's product placement.
Oh, yeah.
Making fun of that product. Like, it's so ridiculous.
Yeah. I don't think it's a matter of people letting them use it. I guarantee you, I bet somebody paid money. They're like, oh, yeah. Fucking Ernst & Young? Hell yeah, we got to get in on this Gremlins business.
Right?
You know?
Like,
fucking idiots.
It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, if you need a good laugh, like, now is the time to totally check this movie out. One of the last things that I want to get to, though, is something that you highlighted. Can you talk to us a little bit about this Twitter account, which is so fucking rad? I cannot begin to describe how cool it is.
So, yeah. So, the Institute of Gremlins 2 Studies is this Twitter account that argues, and in true Gremlins 2 form, it is satire on a level where it's almost impossible to tell when they're being serious and when they're not, but like examines Gremlins 2 from like this wide array of like philosophical and sociological and economic and various different angles, and like 100% straight faced and 90% of the time, I think, accurate.
Oh yeah.
Like, I think their assessment of the film from those lenses is completely true.
Like, yeah. No, you're 100% right. Like, yeah, the philosophies they espouse, the arguments they are making are very much philosophically, technically correct arguments, which I think makes the whole thing so rad to read, especially if you like analyzing movies from a philosophical viewpoint, which is obviously something that we like to do.
It's one of my favorite Twitter accounts. So.
Yeah. Like, at one point, they make this argument, straight-faced, that Elmo is the villain of the movie, because Elmo essentially is...
Gizmo.
Oh yeah, what the hell am I talking about? Gizmo, Elmo, whatever. Elmo is... Elmo should have been in this fucking movie. That has everything else. Gizmo is the true villain of the movie because he leads this extinction-level event against the Gremlins. You know, he's like, look... The Twitter account is like, look, they are sentient beings, right? They can analyze things. They talk about things. They love things, right? Like we see... pursuing of relationships, you know, and it is the human beings led by Gizmo that are trying to wipe out an entire species of things. They are the true enemies. It's like, fuck, this is great. I love it. And it's full of really, I think, brilliant assessments of philosophy. And, you know, like it is a rabbit hole that you could fall down and never climb out of. And
it's fantastic.
I'm still making my way through the backlog of that. We'll put the link to that Twitter in the show notes tonight. So that leads us to, unfortunately, not everybody loves this movie. It's like 90%, I think, on Rotten Tomatoes, so that means a lot of people love it. But somebody that didn't love it was the anonymous Amazon user. Also, in this anonymous Amazon user's one-star review, it features the longest ellipses ever. I was like, is he going to go there? And you'll know exactly why. I'm not sure why anyone would find this film better than watching the grass grow. Certainly is not better than the first Gremlins film, which was charming, funny, and frankly, a story. Gremlins 2 relies on cheap callbacks from its predecessor, slapdash antics, and the weakest excuse of a story. It just doesn't add up. Don't bother with this one, especially if you love Gremlins 1. Gremlins 2 is a waste of both time and money. Maybe rent it with one hand. ... Like, what are we going to do? And hold your nose with the other one, because Gremlins 2 is terrible. You've been warned. It's like, what's he... if he thinks Gremlins 2 is like a porno, then no wonder he is very disappointed.
he was just watching that Sun Worshipper Films bit over and over again.
Yeah. Well, and bits, speaking of bits, the one thing that we haven't mentioned, there is a great Key and Peele bit that discusses Gremlins. So I think you should check that out, and we'll make sure we add that one there. But yeah, clearly... this guy was not in on the joke. And if you're not in on the joke, then I get it. This movie is fucking weird as shit. And maybe not in a way that you enjoy. I don't know.
I feel like a lot of people, especially back when it came out, were not in on the joke. Like,
yeah.
The movie got, like, I don't want to say it got panned, but, like, no one got it.
Yeah.
Everyone was like, it's weird, and it keeps, like, it's jokey in this strange way, and, like, it's, I don't get it. And, like,
yeah.
I was like, that is the joke. You're literally describing the joke. It's,
yeah.
Okay.
there were too many winks and too many nods.
Right.
And like
that's,
yeah,
that's
the winks and the nods were the movie.
Right. Yeah, that's literally the joke. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Also,
well,
before we stop completely, I didn't mention earlier that in spite of all that, like in spite of all the winks and the nods, in spite of all the goofiness and all the ridiculous shit going on in this movie looks amazing. The puppetry in Gremlins 2
is fucking awesome.
Like, I forget how much better the puppetry in Gremlins 2 is than 1 until I watch them both together. And like, 1 is great and fine and all, but like, the puppetry in Gremlins 2 is next level shit. Like Gremlins are amazing.
They are.
And like, I love that people put that much work into the special effects of a movie this goofy.
I think there are moments that are really scary, and it is entirely because of the puppetry, right?
Yeah.
The spider spike gremlin is fucking terrifying. Like, they do a great job with shadow and that kind of stuff to help make him scary. But when you see him, he is a scary dude, you know?
That is a hell of a monster. Like, they designed a hell of a monster
for
that. You're like, yeah, it's an awesome. And there's hundreds of them.
Yeah.
They designed hundreds of monsters for this. Which also, sorry, I'm going to completely derail the end of the episode, apparently.
No, you're good.
Something I love about both Gremlins movies, and both of them do this, is that they're a parody of the rating system, also. Because... like, they're both, I think, PG-13. The first one might be PG, because the first one might have been one of the movies that caused PG-13 to happen.
Yeah,
so
I think I remember
PG-13.
Reading that,
yeah. But, like, they're both rated so the kids can watch them, and they're both movies kids could watch. And they're gory as all hell. Like, just, there is more gore in these films than all the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies put together. It's just all gremlin. Gore.
Yeah, it's all green. Yeah,
it's all green blob. None of it is human blood. But like, the end that we get instead of pumping the building full of concrete, right, is like hundreds of gremlins melting into skeletons.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Flesh
right.
sloughing off into these like melting skeletons. It's super gory and gross, which again is very clearly like a parody of the thing where. Yeah, as long as it's not red human blood, we don't care how much pop you throw at it. No,
right. It's kind of the Mortal Kombat syndrome, right? Like, if it was red, they couldn't put it in the movie, so they changed it to like fucking white or something, and it was just supposed to be sweat.
The first one's the same way. Like, I described the first one at one point to someone as it goes from zero to gory explosion murder in like 2 seconds because like they put a gremlin in a microwave and it blows up.
They do the same thing in this movie, you know? Yep. It's like, goddamn, the gremlins really do not like microwaves at this point. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man. And I think right before that scene where they all melt, right, where they all die, you get this big party, which I think in reference to something else that you said earlier is really a reflection of the way everyone else sees, like, New Year's Eve, right? In New York, it's this big party and, you know, whatever. And it's Times Square. Well, Times Square exists for the gremlins in this moment. And in the pop culture zeitgeist looks very much like that, you know?
Yeah.
Only everybody doesn't melt at the end, which would be fucking.
Usually.
Yeah.
Although, I mean, if we did that right now, they might because, you know, COVID.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Very true. All right, man. I think we have pretty well... dealt with the new batch. So, what I will say is, we have a couple of announcements before we get to our goodbyes that we need to talk about. We will have, a new episode every 2 weeks, but next week we actually will be live on Thursday as part of the Outer Dark Symposium. So a couple of things for our listeners that you are going to get access to watch the movie that we are going to talk about. We're going to watch The Beach House, and we'll have a live tweet along. while we're watching that. But then afterwards, we're going to have a regular horror podcast episode about the Beach House. You can get access to the Beach House through the subscription from Shudder, and you can use the promo code WEIRD with a capital W, and we'll give you a free 30 days. Now, everybody else that is part of the Weird Symposium will get that, but so will our listeners. So you can get that free promo code, get your free 30 days, check out that movie, and then go to the Horror Podcast Study Group on Facebook, which is where we're going to live stream that episode. So it will be live. We will fuck up a lot.
it's going to be... As we fucked up this episode, imagine how much worse it's going to be then.
Oh yeah, man! I'm gonna be sweating like buckets. It'll be not wonderful, but it's gonna be a great time. For real, I have no clue what's gonna happen. It'll be our first live episode, and we cannot stress how thankful we are to, you know, Anya and Scott for allowing us to be part of the Weird Symposium this year, and encourage all of you to sign up for all 3 days worth of readings. Oren, do you have a reading there?
I don't have a reading. I'm on the. The like state of the weird round.
Oh, great!
Panel.
Very cool.
Saturday night, so yeah, I'll be doing that. I think that's it. I think it's just the horror bug lesson that for me. But there's tons of other cool people doing readings and panels and all kind of cool stuff.
Yeah, and it's like $25, which is I don't think terribly expensive. And if money is super tight, send me an email. I'll give you my email here in just a second, and I'll see what I can do to take care of you, because I want everybody to be able to see all this great stuff, because it truly is, I think, a really neat event, and one that we have attended in person that you know, we just can't stress how great it is.
Yeah, so it's amazing, and we would have been there in person this year except for COVID, and so fucking we're doing COVID. It this way instead.
Yep, fucking COVID. All right, Oren, where can they find more of your stuff on the internet?
I am, as always, Oren Gray on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and at OrenGray.com.
Awesome. Very good. Well, you can find me tweeting into the abyss at Ty Unsel and running the day-to-day social media at Signal Horizon. Feel free to send all of your horror podcast stuff or Signal Horizon questions or comments to Tyler at signalhorizon.com. I will do my best to respond to you as soon as possible. We appreciate you listening. Make sure that you check in Thursday at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time to the Horror Podcast Study Group. Check out our live version of The Beach House and all that it brings to the table. And until then, class dismissed.
Where are those happy days? They seem so hard to find. I tried to reach for you, but you have closed your mind. Whatever happened to our love? I wish I understood. It used to be so nice. It used to be so good. So when you're near me, darling, can't you hear me, S.O.S.? The love you gave me, nothing else can save me, S.O.S. When you're gone, how can I even try to go on? When you're gone, though I try, how can I carry on? You seem so far away, though you are standing near. You made me feel alive, but something died, I fear. I really tried to make it out. I wish I understood.